beans, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies Red Sparrow, Death Wish, Midnighters, and Mute. I'm also going to be talking about some news, Oscar predictions, the trailer park, and of course, box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Disney Pixar's Coco. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@themovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
A little bit of news is bubbling around this week based on the whole Me Too movement and all the sexual misconduct stories, which has been going on for, what, like 4 or 5 months that we've really sort of hit a stride with this. And the big one, of course, is the Harvey Weinstein blow-up and everything that came from that. And there's been a little bit of news, not necessarily about Weinstein himself, although there was this little blip on the radar where he tried to use Meryl Streep's positive comments about him as a defense of, well, I never did this, which is an absurd claim because anybody can come out and say that they were nice to somebody, but that doesn't mean that you weren't, you know, a really horrible person to other people. And even she came out and kind of slapped him down for that and was like, hey, just because I said good things and you treated me well does not mean that you weren't awful and terrible to all these other women. But more specifically, the Weinstein Company, the talks of selling that and its library, more importantly, its library, not just the stuff that's in the pipeline, but the stuff that it owns, the talks for the sale of that company have broken down. Which means that they're going to file for bankruptcy. And a lot of people, I've seen a lot of people's reaction of like, oh, good, burn it all down, the heck with Weinstein. These are the unintended victims and the unexpected victims and oftentimes the ignored victims of a scandal this big. Declaring bankruptcy for the Weinstein companies essentially means to shut the entire company down. And yeah, Bob and Harvey Weinstein are going to be left with whatever's left of the bankruptcy, whatever they can keep, which is not going to be nearly as lucrative as having a running functional movie studio. But the thing is, you had like 150 people who worked at the Weinstein Company. So the fact that they couldn't get the sale, which the sale was supposed to include like compensation for victims, and it was actually supposed to be doing good things. It was supposed to be sort of making people whole as best as they could, but that never got worked out. And so now you have 150 people without a job and no help and recovery for the people who were real victims here. That's the downside. And a lot of people, as much as they can cheer the destruction of Harvey Weinstein, he still has plenty of money in his personal bank account. I mean, this guy, you know, sure, he's going to have lawsuits and stuff, but yeah, you got to look at the unintended consequences. And this is what happens when you take down powerful people. You tend to get a lot of blowback and there's a lot of collateral damage in the process. So in a lot of ways, it's like going to war. You go to war, you may knock over a figurehead, but you also kill a lot of people in the army. Now, there's another piece of news that happened this week that kind of took a lot of people by surprise. And I wanted to address it really quickly. Kevin Smith apparently had a heart attack this week. He wrote a post about it on social media, and of course, a lot of people have reacted to it. And look, I have had my differences with Kevin Smith for years. I used to be a huge fan, you know, like 20, 25 years ago when he first came on the scene. I respected the heck out of him. But then I saw his career stagnate, and I saw him never really reach the level that he really had potential for. He sort of was at that level. It never got out of the Jay and Silent Bob set. And not that he didn't try. I mean, he tried new things with Jersey Girl. He tried things with Cop Out, but he never had what it took in terms of personal determination to really become a grown-up star. And so he's still sort of playing around in that sophomoric sandbox. And I even got blocked by him on Twitter back what was it, 2010, 2011, when Cop Out came out. And I had tweeted something out that I said, hey, you know, I saw the movie for free, but I had to drive to Cleveland, so I had to spend actually more money in gas than it would have cost to pay for the movie. You know, am I still allowed to complain about it? And he immediately blocked me. He blocked a whole bunch of people. So there's been sort of this rocky road between Kevin Smith and critics for many years. But I have to say, just on a personal note, you know, take care of yourself, man. You know, you're in your 40s. He and I are about the same age. And I know what it's like to face, you know, health scares and health issues, especially when the warranty goes out in the car and you hit 40 and suddenly, you know, it's like having a, you know, it's like having a 10-year-old car that's constantly breaking down and constantly having problems with it. So yes, you know, I would say, even though I've had my differences with Smith in the past, best of luck to you and take care of yourself. Listen to your doctor and your nutritionist, because you've got a family to worry about too. So best of luck. And I hope everything works out well for him, personally and, from a medical situation. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to touch on is a Netflix film, and I've been sort of covering Netflix a little more lately, last week and even this week. I'm going to be covering a film on that service because I think they're where we may be going with movies, even if they're not always the highest quality. But this one is coming out on March 16th, and that is the remake or reboot of Benji.
No matter who wins, everyone's favorite hero is getting a new home team. Benji. Only on Netflix, March 16th.
There's not much to this trailer, and it's odd that they're going to drop a trailer that's this vague. This feels like a teaser trailer, but it's a trailer they've dropped that is this vague, just a couple weeks before the movie's released. But it just seems to be like overly whimsical, like even just this little cut trailer. It feels like they're going to go for something like the Air Buddies characters than the original Benji. The original Benji movie from the 70s, you know, had a kidnapping in it. It was about, you know, this dog that was helped saving this girl. And it was very much a 70s movie, and it was this cultural phenomenon. And this looks like it's going to be maybe like what that Richie Rich remake TV show is, which looks awful. I like dogs, so, you know, that has my interest there. There's also a new trailer dropping this week for another kids movie, and that is Wreck-It Ralph 2, Ralph Breaks the Internet. This one opens for Thanksgiving on November 21st.
And we are online.
We are going to the internet!
Super excited. Just one minor thing. What is the internet? Oh, holy cow! Look at all this stuff.
Congratulations, you're a winner!
Really?
These 10 child stars went to prison. Ooh. Number 6 will amaze you.
That sounds interesting.
Ralph, come on!
Now, I enjoyed Wreck-It Ralph quite a bit, and part of it is because I grew up in the 80s, and I knew what it was like to play these video games, and I remember when the original Wreck-It Ralph came out, they actually built a full video game console that did tours, and I played it. They actually had it at the local theater, and it was actually distressed. It was scuffed up and stuff, and I brought my oldest son, and he got the high score on it and was all upset because then I went to that theater later and I saw somebody else had his high score. But this was a cute little movie, and it was before Frozen just steamrolled everything and became a totally different world. This one looks like it might be stretching it a little bit. You know, it looks like it might be, it's in danger of going to where the Emoji Movie went. And not that the Emoji Movie was a travesty, but it certainly was an unnecessary exercise. And I hope that this one has a plot and has the heart that the original one did, so it doesn't just turn into the Emoji Movie Part 2 starring Wreck-It Ralph. And that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Death Wish and Mute. guys at the movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews for the week. And the first one I want to talk about is Death Wish. Bruce Willis stars in Eli Roth's remake of the 70s thriller about a doctor who turns into a vigilante after his family is attacked.
I love my family. I failed to protect them.
I'm sorry, Dr. Kersey, nothing yet.
So there's nothing that I can do? Is that what you're saying?
Can I have faith?
If a man really wants to protect what's his, he has to do it for himself.
The men who did it are out there. I'm gonna hunt them down. One by one.
As a kid, I never actually saw the original Death Wish. My mom was really against it. She was very much, she didn't like me play. Actually, she didn't like me playing with guns. We come from a family that, my grandfather was very much into guns, and he hunted and all that. And my mom didn't have a problem with guns, but she didn't like me playing with. She didn't like them as a toy, and always, you know, I grew up in the age of Star Wars, so not cowboys and Indians. So she would only buy me guns that looked like laser pistols. If it looked like a regular revolver, she wouldn't allow me to play with it. And so, of course, I mean, I was a little kid when Death Wish, the first one, came out. But she never wanted to see those. She hated those movies. She thought they were overly violent and didn't want me to have anything to do with them. So I didn't see the original Death Wish until I was probably at least in my 30s. And it's a good movie. And I think it's a real interesting movie. It certainly put Charles Bronson on the map as a modern tough guy back in the 70s. And I mean, along with movies like The Mechanic. And it sparked something culturally. When I saw that they were remaking this, I thought, oh, this might be interesting. And I said, oh, you know, Bruce Willis, that's an odd choice. It's sort of like how Stephen King didn't like Jack Nicholson for Jack Torrance in The Shining, because he's like, you knew he was bonkers from frame one. The whole point of The Shining is Jack Torrance was a very normal, sane man who then is corrupted and becomes insane in the Overlook Hotel. And I think that's part of the problem with this movie is by casting Bruce Willis. I mean, he's had, 30 some years of being the gun-toting tough guy. Bruce Willis shooting guns is nothing new. So like when he's playing sort of the peaceful surgeon at the beginning, you just don't buy it. And it's very corny and cheesy because you know where it's going. So Bruce Willis has no change in the movie, even though he tries to in the acting. Plus Eli Roth is about as subtle as a sledgehammer. And there was a certain amount of subtlety to the original Death Wish. And there's a certain amount of nuance, a lot of that brought by Charles Bronson, and also where the story goes. In this one, it plays out very much the same way, that there's this charming, like, wonderful family, and then random acts of violence get after them, and he becomes a vigilante and starts going after people. But then it never loses sight in this new movie of him going after the people that did him wrong. So it's really not as much the 1974 Death Wish, which was different than the book, for that matter, which the book condemned vigilante violence and the original movie sort of glorifies it. This one, it's less about the vigilanteism and it's more about him just kind of going for revenge. And in that sense, you've seen this movie a billion times before. And as a throwaway shoot-'em-up action movie, it's okay. It's not very well directed and it's not very well acted. And it's, like I said, it's not subtle at all, but it's not culturally significant the way the original Death Wish was. And I think culturally as a country, we're in a very different place now in 2018 than we were in 1974. And I'm not even talking about sort of the movie's unfortunate timing of coming out 2 weeks after a school shooting, where firearms and the Second Amendment and gun control is on the big national debate stage. But, like, take that out of the mix, although I think that's going to negatively impact its box office. It's very different now in terms of what people are afraid of. People are afraid of unnecessary random acts of violence, but those tend to be clustered, at least in the milieu, of terrorism and school shootings and that kind of thing, where you have no control and then somebody comes in and randomly starts just wanting to kill people, as opposed to what was going on in the 70s when you had street crime rates going up, muggings and purse snatching, and that was really on the rise in the 70s and through the late 60s. So that's why I think that original Death Wish took off, because there was a frustration culturally that you could be a victim of violence and have done nothing wrong in the first place. Whereas, like, even in this movie, they point out that a lot of these unsolved cases, that they have a point where he goes into the detective's office. He's got the big board of all the open cases. And he says, most of these are gang-on-gang violence. Well, I think a lot of people, you know, whether or not it's true, a lot of people think, well, I can avoid gang-on-gang violence. That's very easy to avoid. Just, you know, live in the right neighborhood. Don't go in the bad neighborhoods. In the original Death Wish, it was that this stuff was all over the place and you couldn't escape it just walking down the street, especially like a place like New York City. You know, now they've moved it to Chicago because that's become the epicenter for saying, oh, this is violence in the area. So I think culturally this doesn't hit a note the way the original did. And it's just, it's okay, but it's really also not that good. So I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Mute really quickly. This is a Netflix film, and it released about a week ago on the service, and I wanted to check it out mainly because of who directed it. It's directed by Duncan Jones, who, if you don't know who that is of course the guy who did Moon and Source Code and Warcraft, and he's David Bowie's son. So Duncan Jones directs this futuristic detective story about a mute man looking for his missing girlfriend.
I don't deserve you, Leo.
I love you so much, but you don't know me.
I want to know what the deal is with this crazy bartender.
This kind of thing hurts my reputation.
Your girlfriend has secrets.
This is going to stop right now.
It ain't a secret anymore.
Now, a lot of people fell in love with Moon, which was a pretty good movie. I thought it was okay, but I wasn't a huge fan, but I loved Source Code. Warcraft was okay, but the problem with Warcraft is it was a video game movie that didn't translate to the big screen, just like most video games movies don't, because it had all these things that it had to hit for the game that your average person didn't care about. And while it did very well overseas, it kind of flopped in the US, and rightfully so, because it wasn't a good movie. And this is him trying to go back to his sort of like gritty cultural roots, like with Moon, and he actually has some tie-ins to Moon in this movie. The problem is, it's just boring. And that's one of the biggest problems that you can have. There's nothing about the characters that's likable. Everybody is kind of awful, or they're not given a reason to be likable. Like even the woman who goes missing, you know, you want to feel bad for the missing woman. You want her to get home, but there's no depth to her. She's just, oh, I love you, but I have a bad past and I'm going to disappear. But they show no real development, and that's the hinging part of it. You know, then you have the bad guys, and even then he's trying to make them great characters, and Paul Rudd plays one of the bad guys, but he's not very well developed. It's just kind of a mess, and that's a shame, because I think Duncan Jones is really trying to do something, and I think he's pushing back on the criticism he got from Warcraft, but he did so in a way that nobody really liked. So I'd like to see more of Source Code, but this thing just doesn't quite gel. And it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Red Sparrow and Midnighters.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the Jennifer Lawrence nude movie, Red Sparrow. Jennifer Lawrence stars as a Russian agent trained in the art of sexual manipulation.
From this day forward, you will become sparrows. Weapons in a global struggle for power. You'll be trained in psychological manipulation. You must learn to push yourself beyond all limitation. Every human being is a puzzle of need. You must become the missing piece, and they will tell you anything.
Now, I, of course, introduced it as the Jennifer Lawrence nude movie. And the reason I did that, I have to admit, I was curious. When I first was hearing this movie coming out, and I saw it was R-rated, and I saw that the narrative that the publicity department was trying to spin was that it's, of course, Jennifer Lawrence breaking her somewhat good girl image that she had with, like, the Hunger Games and the X-Men movies, and it's her doing a more adult role. And you see this with actresses all the time. Anne Hathaway did it when she did the movie Havoc. You also saw this with, obviously, Miley Cyrus is the most extreme example that we've seen recently. But the reason I point that out is because I do radio calls every week, and I get asked by hosts throughout almost every host is like, so Jennifer Lawrence gets naked in this one, doesn't she? And apparently they're writing stories about this in the news, and she's going out and talking about it. And I think they're pushing it. I think there's a certain thought process by the studios that says you're going to get more butts in the seat if you know Jennifer Lawrence butts on the screen. But I mean, the reality though is, my God, we have the internet, and you can see any of that anytime you want to. And gosh, give this movie a couple months and all the screen captures and clips are going to be online anyway. So you don't have to go to the IMAX to go see, unless you really want to see Jennifer Lawrence breasts, 30 feet tall. And nothing's wrong with that. But if your big selling point is Jennifer Lawrence is naked, you don't have much of a movie. The movie is, it has such potential, and what I was hoping for was maybe something like Atomic Blonde, but I mean, Atomic Blonde was really over the top, like John Wick. I didn't expect something like that, but I was maybe expecting something like an international thriller like that, that kind of has a easy to follow story, or something like, a James Bond movie. That's, I think, where James Bond, the Russian version of James Bond, but with a woman. But James Bond movies are so cartoony at a certain point that you end up either becoming what Atomic Blonde was, or you got to dial it back so much to make it a little more realistic that you lose any sort of oomph to it. I mean, this is less of a spy movie like a James Bond film than it is like something like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is really about the way spying is, which is kind of boring. A bunch of people sit in a room listening to things. And Jennifer Lawrence does fine in the movie. She's good in the film, and she gives it her all. And I think her performance is the thing that really saves the movie from just being impossible to watch. And she's beautiful. And I mean, she's great. Everything's resting on her shoulders. Unfortunately, they put so much on her shoulders and they don't give her any other support, like a good story and characters and development. Even her character is woefully underdeveloped for what she's trying to be. And because you want to be sympathetic, the character in this movie, you need this character to be sympathetic. And we're not really given much to make her sympathetic aside from the fact that she's sort of put in this unfortunate situation, and she's Jennifer Lawrence, so you just naturally like her. She's got a great screen presence. But we don't see much of her humanity in this movie, and part of it also is the character. Yes, she's in perilous situations, and yes, she's tortured and has all these awful things happen to her, but she's not, and I mean this in a figurative sense, she's not stripped down so that her character is built back up by the spy agency. Even when she's in uncomfortable situations, it's kind of at her own power. And at no point is she debased so completely that they could build her back up, and that you don't get the full character arc of that. You don't get the officer and a gentleman moment. You don't get her doing push-ups in the mud the way where he completely breaks down and bears himself, emotionally. You don't really get that in this movie. And I think that's because they're kind of playing it safe as much as it's trying not to. Also, and I have to bring this up because, again, she's been out there on talk shows talking about how she's empowered by this and, because she had that cell phone leak. So if you already want to see naked pictures of Jennifer Lawrence, they're out there on the internet because she was involved in that cell phone hack several years ago. And I think her idea was, well, my boobs are already out there. Why not get paid and have some control over it? And so she's talking about how empowering it is and everything. And that's great. But on the same token, you watch this movie and she looks like she looks great, but she also looks like she's lost more weight than she probably should. I mean, she still has curves because just naturally she develops those, but she looks like she lost a lot of weight for this movie and toned herself a lot, which is great. But we've come to a stage where if you point out an actress's weight, one way or the other, you're in trouble. But it looks like she lost a lot more than I've ever seen her lose. And she's always struggled with the body image issue. And eventually Hollywood takes its toll. And as much as she's like, I don't care, I'll eat whatever I want to, she's not. It's clear that she's putting a lot of work into this. And this happens on both men and women. I've heard stories where, like, Ryan Gosling's talked about how, you know, struggle it is to, you know, stay fit. And same thing, Chris Pratt. I mean, so it's not like guys are just all allowed to be fat and doughy. You know, for these roles, they still require you to be thin. I mean, Joel Edgerton in Red Sparrow's very fit. But I guarantee you, in the next couple of years, you're going to get a story that comes out that Jennifer Lawrence is going to be like, oh yeah, I had to go through all this crash dieting and it wasn't healthy to get that body that I had in Red Sparrow. Same thing you saw after any movie where somebody like loses a lot of weight or really trims down for a role. Somebody like, I remember when Jessica Simpson did that to play Daisy Duke. The whole thing is, this is supposed to be empowering, but it's also, I think, making her do stuff that she doesn't necessarily need to do. So it's this weird mix of misplaced feminism for the movie. But the movie's not that good to begin with. So I'm just going to have to say that Red Sparrow kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Midnighters. After killing a pedestrian on the way home from a New Year's Eve party, a married couple discovers his true intentions when they try to cover things up.
There's nothing that we could have done.
Wait, that's our address. He was on his way here. Is there anything you've done that would make someone come after you?
I am Detective Smith.
Does your sister live with you?
She's with my husband.
I'm trying to protect us and you're screwing it up.
There is a dead man in your garage.
We have to do something about this mess.
This movie has some neat stuff going on in it. There is some interesting character moments, and there's an interesting sort of crime and cover up of a crime. The biggest problem that I had with this movie was it's like aggressively told out of order. I mean, it's chronological, but they kind of hit the ground running and you're getting stuff revealed about the characters as things move on. And so by the time you're about halfway through with the movie, you know all the puzzle pieces that are on the table or the chess pieces that are ready to attack. But you're not given any of those at the beginning. And so then we have this happening. And you're like, really? That would have been nice to know at the beginning. And I guess it's supposed to be a bait and switch because you're supposed to feel more sympathy and then your sympathy can erode through the movie. Part of it is also, these are the dumbest people on the planet. I mean, this guy, they accidentally hit him. And they're trying to do the right thing, but they're also not wanting to get arrested for drunk driving. And then they find out he has a gun and he has their house number and he was coming. And then they're just like, oh, well, we'll just stay here. And I'm like, look, if I were to hit somebody and if I find out they had a gun and my address written on a piece of paper, I wouldn't stay in my address. I'd get the heck out. I'd go somewhere else. I would say, look, obviously somebody's coming to hurt me. So they're doing, they have a lot of stupidity in this movie and they don't make the right decisions. And that erodes the sympathy I have for the characters. Plus there's a lot of logical inconsistencies that don't work. But if you want just sort of like that independent thriller, it actually works as kind of this character study. Once you get the characters out on the table and you can find a certain amount of entertainment and watching them turning into what they end up being. So I'm going to give Midnighters a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Oscar predictions, the box office, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Coco. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the show with a look at the Oscars. Is it me, or is the Oscars just not getting the buzz that it's gotten in the past? I mean, I know online you have these pockets of people. I mean, the fact that the nominations came out and you had some somewhat diverse nominations. I mean, you had Get Out have a couple nominations, which some of them surprised the heck, you know, like Best Picture. Just because no one expected that, you know, horror movie from earlier in the year getting Best Picture, you know, about black people. Then the actor getting, him getting a nomination for Best Actor, and also Lady Bird getting nominated. The Lady Bird nominations aren't as surprising as Get Out, because Lady Bird was clearly in the running as an Oscar contender, whereas a film like Get Out, just simply because it sets itself up as a horror movie, satire slash comedy, all that kind of thing, the fact that it got a Golden Globe noms and stuff, it didn't feel like Oscar material, but it got nominated, and that's great. But once that story kind of came and went, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of interest in the awards this year. I don't think they're going to win anything. They might win like a best screenplay nomination, but they're not going to win best picture. They just won't. It's that the Academy doesn't vote that way. And really, Get Out not winning best picture, it really has nothing to do with it being a movie directed by a black guy or a movie about black people. It's because it's a horror movie. Horror movies, with the exception of Silence of the Lambs, they don't win the Academy Award. And even then, a lot of people are going to argue that Silence of the Lambs is a drama, not a horror movie, although it's a horror movie through and through. Watch the movie and watch how it's directed. It's a horror movie. It's a serial killer movie. But I think people think it transcends the genre. And so does Get Out. But I think in terms of sort of like overall art and respect from the film community, and I'm talking about the older, whiter film community, it's going to take a couple years for Get Out to really get the respect that it has, because it's going to be seen as an exploitation flick in a lot of ways. But I think that it's just kind of like, it's not getting as much buzz this time. And I think that's because there's no huge blockbuster on there. You know, it's like when Avatar was going up against the Hurt Locker, I think that got a little bit of buzz. The other reason is I don't think there's no real front runner. There's no real movie that's going to sweep, like when Titanic swept pretty much all these categories. You know, it's kind of all spread around, and that negatively impacts the Oscar buzz. But in terms of shoo-ins, I think in terms of the top six, let's talk, you know, the picture, director, actor, actress, supportings. I think that the shoo-ins, you've got Gary Oldman's going to win for best actor for Darkest Hour. I think he's won it everywhere else. And it was such a good performance in terms of actually becoming the character. I think he's a shoo-in. I think that Allison Janney is going to be a shoo-in for best supporting actress for I, Tonya. I mean, Laurie Metcalf was great in Lady Bird, but it's just, you know, if she just wasn't up against Allison Janney for I, Tonya. And then in terms of the supporting actor, I think that Sam Rockwell is pretty close to being a shoo-in for Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, even though that there's been this backlash against that film. I think that backlash is mostly existing online in like film Twitter, but it really hasn't spilled over outside of that little realm yet. And in that sense, I think that also, this isn't a shoo-in. Those three are shoo-ins. But I really think that Frances McDormand has a really good shot of picking up Best Actress for Three Billboards, because you know, she's fantastic in that movie. And I'd love to see her win, because she has been around for decades, and she's been a great actress, and she's done so many good roles. It'd be great to see her get some recognition. And plus, I think she deserves it, absolutely, in that field. Now, in terms of the Best Picture, Best Director, sometimes we've had it split, but I think we're going to see it be the same movie. I think it's going to be Shape of Water. I think that even though there's a lot of taboos in that movie, I think it's the one that's sort of like most loved. It gives everyone the best feeling, and it's the least polarizing of all the movies. You know, Three Billboards tends to be polarizing. Get Out, because it's a horror movie, same thing, you know. So I think that you're going to see that win Best Picture. I think Guillermo del Toro is going to win Best Director, which, an interesting thing when you talk diversity, if del Toro wins Best Director, it's going to be like the third, well, he's Puerto Rican. He's lived in Mexico. He used to make films in Mexico, but I think that Guillermo del Toro is Puerto Rican. When you take him and Iñárritu and Alfonso Cuarón for Gravity, they're all Hispanic, and that's a certain thing to say about diversity in the Oscars. So I think that would be interesting. But I think also the Academy wants to give it to del Toro. I think people love him. He's kind of a warm and fuzzy guy, and it's going to make people feel good to give that directing Oscar to him. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office. Once again, Black Panther is just steamrolling over everything. And no, there's going to be the same win for Black Panther this weekend. Red Sparrow is not going to come anywhere close to beating Black Panther. But in terms of the weekend, it was a banner weekend, because it was one of the only, like, the first couple movies that did over $100 million. And the original number was 108, and then it ballooned to 111 million. It's every estimate you see for Black Panther, it always ends up coming in better. So it's got records all over the place, and it's going into the weekend with near $500 million. It's probably going to end up, you know, well over $500 million by the end of the weekend. This is a juggernaut. And Game Night did 17, which is about on par with the other stuff that Jason Bateman has released, like Horrible Bosses 2 and Office Christmas Party. Annihilation did not do terribly well, 11 million. And part of that reason is I think it's a polarizing film. Second of all, I think that there are some problems with it for real sci-fi fans. And third, I think it was mismarketed and mishandled. Every Day barely made it into the top 10. It came in ninth with $3 million. And kind of the movies that are the little movies that could are Peter Rabbit and Jumanji is still kicking, as well as The Greatest Showman. All those are still tending to drop very, very little and doing extremely well with legs. So that's, I think, not going to change much this weekend with the Oscars. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is going to be on Coco, which is probably going to win for best animated film, by the way, of the Oscars. But a Mexican boy travels to the land of the dead to reunite with his ancestors.
What's going on? I'm just dreaming.
Welcome to the land of the dead.
Doctor, clean up!
You gotta stay with me, boy.
This isn't a dream, then.
I know your great-great-grandpa.
I'll get you to him.
There's no one left in the living world who remembers you. You disappear from this world.
But you can change that.
We gotta find my great grandpa.
You gotta do it by sunrise.
What happens at sunrise?
You'll be stuck here forever. What?
This was a charming film. What's funny is, I mean, I liked it, and it's beautiful, and it's gorgeously animated, and it's everything that Pixar is in terms of a force of nature when it comes to animated films. It was not my favorite Pixar movie, though, and that's not bad. Coco's a great movie, and because you're dealing with going up against stuff like the Toy Story franchise and A Bug's Life and WALL-E and The Incredibles. It's tough to be the best Pixar movie I've ever seen. And it's so weird that your barometer gets reset because you watch this movie. You expect to get blown away by Pixar movies, and this didn't blow me away, but it's still such a vibrant, gorgeous, and very well-made movie. It's great. I don't know what else to say about Coco, but it's a charming, wonderful little film. I think it opens up the Pixar universe culturally. I think that that's good. I think there's certainly a great service to Mexicans in the Day of the Dead and the Land of the Dead. They did that movie that Guillermo del Toro had worked on that dealt with the same mythology, where it did deal with going to visit your afterlife of your ancestors. This one handles it very differently. So it doesn't feel like it's a ripoff, doesn't feel like it's rehashing a previous film. It's kind of a boy and his dog going to the land of the dead, but it's not scary. That's the thing. You describe the movie to somebody who doesn't know anything about Mexican culture, and they're like, this sounds terrifying. It's a zombie movie. No, it's not. I mean, yeah, it's got skeletons in it, but it's got skeletons in a very family-friendly, charming sort of way. There's some decent behind-the-scenes stuff. But it's not fantastic, not groundbreaking. But it has, you know, like a commentary track and deleted scenes, and it tells sort of like some background on developing the movie and the music. But the real reason to get this is for the presentation, because once they get to the Land of the Dead, it is vibrant and gorgeous, and it's one of the most beautifully animated films that you're going to see, as you would have seen this year. And I think that's part of the reason it's going to win the best animated film. Plus, it's Pixar. Pretty much you can randomly put your money on Pixar, and with rare exceptions, it tends to win the Oscar. So I'm going to have to say that Coco still rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
A couple other movies that are out this week that are award films, including Murder on the Orient Express, Darkest Hour, and Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And that is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Disney's A Wrinkle in Time. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.